Welcome to the V&A Podcast, bringing you behind the scenes of the Victoria and Albert Museum, the world's greatest museum of art and design. I'm Glenn Adamson, head of research at the V&A. In this episode, we'll be talking about curating pop music at the museum. Most people think of the V&A as a museum of decorative art and design, but we have paintings, sculpture, architecture, and much more in our collections. We also have a department of theater and performance, and one of the subjects under their care is pop music. With the V&A's latest show, David Bowie Is, setting records for ticket sales, pop music is becoming ever more important to the museum. But what are the possibilities and challenges of presenting this material, which some visitors may see as unconventional or even unserious, in our exhibition galleries? Here to discuss curating pop music at the V&A are Vicky Brokes, head of exhibitions for our theater and performance collections, and Paul Morley, who has been one of the world's leading music journalists since he got his start at the New Musical Express in the late 1970s. So, Paul, you've consulted with the V&A on our show about David Bowie, and I understand that you actually came up with the title, which is David Bowie Is. So I wanted to ask you about that. Why the present tense? Why David Bowie Is?
The present tense very much because I was feeling that something would be naturally retrospective and naturally looking back. There was something about the idea of David Bowie I've always felt could be anywhere at any time in any place, and somehow it seemed negative to fix it in one particular place. So I like the idea of the fluidity. And I thought it was important it had a title as well, because I was very worried personally, just on the level of it might be just David Bowie the Exhibition, something like that. Whereas I thought what would be fantastic about it, if it had a title, it would become part of the David Bowie canon, if you like. You know, there would be everything he does, tours, albums, things, they have names, they have labels. So I thought it'd be quite good that it actually had a title, and therefore a title that gave it its own character, and a title that led on to the fact that you could develop slogans, and it could be is something, and was it a question mark after it, an exclamation mark, a dot, 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 and everybody could come up with what their own version of David Bowie is.
That raises an interesting question, Paul. I think a lot of people wonder when they hear that we've done this show with David Bowie, the extent to which it's also a show by David Bowie, whether he curated it, for example. And I wonder, to what extent was this exhibition actually produced by David Bowie as if it were an album or a tour? And to what extent is it a product that of the museum that was created outside of the David Bowie world?
Yeah, I love that element, actually, of whether David Bowie was atmospherically involved in some kind of, you know, metaphysical way almost, because what was beautiful, and I think it was what he ultimately wanted, was that it was the V&A, it was the Victoria and Albert Museum doing it. But also he didn't want to relinquish control, because one of the great things about David Bowie obviously is control. He wants to control everything, and he has controlled everything to the extent that there is now this much material that can appear in an exhibition. Very few people plan that far ahead. So it was a wonderful tension I felt between him relinquishing a certain amount of control, which then, again, he enjoys, because I think he also needs to feel to have the interpretation, if you like, to see other interpretation of what it is he does so he can adjust accordingly. So I think it was, for me, funnily enough, being a journalist from the 60s and 70s and 80s, when rock journalism had a certain sort of more direct influence and power, I think someone like David Bowie, who used that back in those days as part of how he developed his context, misses having that critical context, if you like, the greater context that reflects and tells him what it is he's doing to react to. So I saw this as his way of sort of generating a new form of critical attention now that that kind of rock journalism has died, if you like. So I felt it had a certain echo of that. He enjoyed seeing how others interpreted him, both for his own ego, obviously, but also just to get a sense of what it is he's doing and how he can control furthering that into the ultimate legacy.
So, Vicky, you were one of two co-curators, along with Jeff Marsh, who provided this critical context for David Bowie and his career. Can you say a little bit about why the V&A chose to do an exhibition on this artist? There are so many pop stars out there. Why David Bowie?
Well, that's really interesting. But I wanted just to go back to what Paul was saying, because I haven't thought of it in exactly that way. But it's interesting because we haven't really had that critical look in the exhibition in the way I guess I was expecting. And what we tend to find is that people write a few paragraphs about the exhibition and then they talk about their own personal journey with David Bowie, and that comes up again and again. And so to move on to your actual question, I think obviously Bowie is a pioneer not just in music but in many different ways, in video, in staging. He also is A is somebody who's challenged the status quo, who gets his ideas from an enormous range of places, and also who's influenced so many people, so many creative people. So we carry on seeing these sort of Bowie effects on and on now. So lots of reasons.
So, Paul, let me ask you, what happens when you put pop music into a museum? We're used to seeing musicians, I suppose, in music videos, certainly in the pages of magazines, as you know well, and in films, perhaps. What happens when you put music into a space where people might normally expect to see painting and sculpture?
Well, that's the interesting moment, and I felt it was an interesting moment with Bowie himself, and it's inevitable and necessary that he should be the first, because he always wants to be the first, that this kind of thing... Well, I know not actually, but in a way... As a sort of representation of how this thing might carry through the next few decades, it's an important moment because obviously to some extent pop, because it's embedded in the commercial world, gets dismissed or sneered at by certain parties for therefore not being needing even the kind of exposure that it gets once it goes into a museum. But for me, it does need that sort of stamp of something substantial and permanent to prove that it was more than just commercial endeavour, and that the commercial endeavour was merely part of the certainly in David Bowie's world. You know, it's this wonderful way that artists, great pop artists like David Bowie, managed to transmit quite often quite tricky avant-garde ideas to a wider audience. You know, that alone makes him a kind of artist. It makes him definitely an artist. And I think it was a fascinating moment for me to see, what, in terms of what I was talking about before, the idea of previously this was done in a very small world, the world of rock criticism. And the idea for me now is that the bigger framing, the bigger contextualizing of some of these great artists needs this movement. And the museums themselves need it, because they need to make the move to some of these pop singers and pop musicians to demonstrate and interpret how they are also artists. And David Bowie is a classic example of how that can be done, because in a way he's a great artist who just happened to be you know, grow up at a time when how to represent yourself as an artist, the most seductive available ways of doing that was sound and song and performance and costume. But he didn't mean he was any less of an artist than other people at the time going into sculpture or painting, and I think this is a moment when that can be confirmed or at least proposed that someone like Bowie deserves to be in this position, and the V&A makes a decision to do that, and they take a risk, but they also make that move forward. How will this be done in terms of, you know, will we just be selling his product? Will we be just part of his promotional campaign? Will we just be hyping him? And I think some people who dismiss it tend to think it's going to be like that, as if that isn't the case in other worlds as well, really. So I think it's a fascinating moment, that period we're in, where if we're really going to amplify the importance of this 50, 60-year period. It does go into the museums.
So, Vicky, do you agree with Paul that there's need on both sides? In other words, the pop music world perhaps needs the verification, the substance that the museums bring. But then, let's take us as an example, the V&A in some sense needs or certainly benefits from introducing pop music into our galleries.
I mean, pop music may like it as a verification, but I think, you know, it's clear that Bowie doesn't need us to help him sell records, for example, although it can't have done any harm to his kind of cultural standing. Well, it's obviously, you know, done great good to his cultural standing. So there's that issue. I think, really, though, we as museums, we do seriously need to look at this seriously. And I'm very proud, in fact, to be part of the museum that is doing that. I mean, we actually, in the museum, we've been collecting in the rock and pop era since the 1970s, but we haven't really been showing it to people. But I think, as Paul says, this is a way... You know, what are exhibitions about? What do we want exhibitions to be about? And I think, you know, it depends on the subject of the exhibition, but often it's a way of looking at the world around you, looking at yourself, looking at the world around you. And I think music exhibitions give us the opportunity to do that in a really exciting way that also connects with the visual culture and the material culture, all the things we do already in a museum. There's so many people who've written in about the exhibition have said it... I went away and it made me think, you know, they've said things like, you know, I feel like such a lazy so-and-so when I see everything that Bowie has done. But that's just an example of the many things where you see he's had his ups and downs, but he's kept trying. He's tremendously hardworking. He's risk-taking, all of those things. And I think that is inspirational as well. And I think a lot of people see it like that.
Vicky, can I ask you to say a little bit more in detail about how the V&A approaches pop music and curating this material beyond Bowie? As you say, we've been doing it for decades now. And you said that we try to take it seriously in a way that probably some other institutions do as well. But what does that mean? What's the concrete?
Well, I think there's you know, obviously there are museums whose subject is pop music. So, Experience Music Project or Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or British Music Experience have all been doing this. And I mean, certainly, I think it's time music kind of came in from the cold, and that's why I'm pleased that we're doing it. But it is also true that we do it in a different way, I think, at the V&A, and that's sort of necessary. I mean, for a start, we need things to look at, and that's not necessarily the case maybe in a music museum where you can do it through sound and you can look at musical instruments and things. We actually need a visual culture. So someone like Bowie is kind of completely perfect, and someone like Bob Dylan wouldn't be completely perfect at the V&A.
Because we need original artifacts of incredible visual appeal, basically.
Yeah, I think we do. At this stage, I think we do. Although it's an interesting question, actually, because if we're saying that music now represents the world in a way that in the Renaissance you might have used painters to represent the world, then we may have to get over that. But I think kind of where we are now, we are looking at people who probably have a sort of have a performance angle. We are, after all, the Department of Theatre and Performance, so we're taking it from the performance, the visual presentation end. And luckily for us, you know, Bowie brought all those things together, art, design and performance.
I think also just looking at the history of pop now that we've got a distance from it in a way, because it's a late 20th century phenomenon to some extent, although it's obviously got its echoes now and the aftermath still continues. But effectively, it was a moment, and you realise looking back that a lot of it wasn't actually about the music. The music actually wasn't the most important thing. It was the context that was the most important thing, the record sleeves, the artwork, the photographs, the costumes that the musicians wore, the performance. The music, in a way, was fantastic and was the right kind of soundtrack to this extraordinary combination of things. But I mean, as Vicky knows well, you know, one of my... I over-panicked at the beginning with the V&A doing the exhibition because I was particularly not in favour of the way that these other places do it, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fames, the music experience things, because they just put a guitar on a wall as if that tells you enough about what goes on. They get obsessed with the idea of the gold discs. They get obsessed with this other thing that actually the thing isn't really about. And as Vicky knows, I did panic a little bit.
He did panic.
I shouldn't have panicked as much as I did. But I was slightly worried that it might go down that road because to an extent it's a temptation. It probably still would have been popular. But I think it did have to have this other critical dimension, this other contextual dimension, which indeed it does have, that it didn't simply become about souvenirs and a sort of memorial. Again, nostalgic. You know, it's difficult not to be nostalgic, but I always feel when I go to a great exhibition of anything from the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century, if it's fantastic, it doesn't feel nostalgic. It feels about power and greatness that just happened to be then. And I think the problem with the pop idea is sometimes it can be sentimental and sentimentalized and just be about, oh, how great it was when I was younger. And for me, it had to kind of be taken away from that somewhat so that you weren't really just going on a theme ride, if you like. You know, although, oddly enough, you do go on a theme ride with this exhibition, but a really wonderful psychedelic theme ride. You know, it's more sort of about other things than just your, although your own memories are important, other things than just memories of when you were younger. It's about how an individual happened to invent an entire personality, a complicated personality over a period of time, and keep developing that over a period of time, which I think is very much about now and the future, because obviously that's what a lot of people do now with their lives. Bowie, in a way, was a pioneer about how people are now constructing their identity online. They're creating other characters, you know, other names for themselves, other images for themselves. You know, in that sense, he was incredibly pioneering. And it's that side of David Bowie I find more interesting in a way than the music, you know, and that an exhibition like this can really kind of communicate that side of him.
Vicky, Paul just mentioned something that I wanted to ask you about, which is the quality of this exhibition as a pilgrimage for visitors, and he was talking about this idea of the memorabilia, the souvenirs. I suppose we could also call them relics of this person who perhaps doesn't only remind us of an online avatar, but also of a medieval saint. And he does somehow cross these categories of time and history in an amazing way. What do you think about the almost religious connotations of doing an exhibition on a figure who's so revered, almost held up as a kind of holy man or wise man, like pop stars often are?
I think there's no doubt that there's an element of that. I think of the exhibits, there's only one that I would think absolutely is a holy relic, and that's a tissue with lipstick on. And we did debate long and hard about whether to put that in, actually, because of that. It's quite interesting. I think almost every other object in there tells another story as well. That seemed to be a pure bit of reliquary. I mean, it's a very interesting question. I think people, without doubt, they come to pay homage in a way, and why shouldn't they? Why shouldn't we all have our you know, today's saints that we do that with? I think it's interesting with the museum as a whole, actually. People come to it as a sort of place of pilgrimage. They come to congregate, and that will be part of it. But that's not obviously the whole way we're presenting the exhibition there. As I say, most objects have many other reasons they might be there.
I suppose that many artists are treated as saints in that way, or people to revere like Picasso or Matisse would be treated that way. But maybe art museums don't have to answer that criticism in the way that we do when we curate pop music, which is quite a fascinating situation we found ourselves in. Paul, could you say a little bit about what you would say to a critic, so a skeptic who says pop music has no place in the museum? How would you mount a defense on our behalf if you were speaking for the V&A?
Well, I would probably agree about 97% of it, actually, because there is a glut of it at the moment and most of it is absolute rubbish. But the actual highlights, the great moments in this period of pop music, you know, post-war, the great stars, those that presented themselves as extraordinary artists in a commercial setting and managed to, you know, transmit very emotional, strange feelings, magical feelings. And they say that about the relics. There's a kind of magic there as well. And it's an important magic about how an entertainer becomes so important in your life, because it's educational as well. It's educational in all sorts of ways that aren't conventional. As I was growing up, you know, I was taught very, very badly at school. Someone like David Bowie as a teacher was quite extraordinary because of the things he was interested in that's demonstrated in the museum. You know, a David Bowie interview would take you to so many different sorts of places in terms of literature and theatre. You know, David Bowie mentioned Baudelaire, David Bowie mentioned Artaud, David Bowie mentioning Jean Cocteau. You know, your world was lit up, and that can't be underestimated. So I think there's still an incredible mainstream institutional condescension to the true artistic power of great pop music. I mean, I suppose the word pop doesn't help, or rock indeed. These words don't help. But, you know, for me, David Bowie is a 20th century sort of phenomenon. You know, the it would have been impoverished without someone like David Bowie. The fact that he happened to be a pop musician is just one of those things. But as a great thinker, a great artist, a great leader, David Bowie had made things from nothing that had an enormous impact on an enormous amount of people. And the idea you make a judgment on that and say it's somehow lesser than other forms of art and craft and creativity, I obviously don't believe.
Vicky, can I ask you a more technical question about curating pop music? What are the actual challenges of pulling it off in the galleries? Because, you know, you go to a stage show in a stadium or something like that, and of course it does have that magic and that power.
Yes.
But getting that in a gallery is really, really tough. So how do you take this content that was never meant to be sitting still in a space with a label in front of it and get it
make
to work?
It interesting. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it is a challenge. And I think, you know, I'd just like to say that although Bowie was not in control of this exhibition in any way, we did try and bring the sort of Bowie. We would say, well, how would Bowie think about it? And of course, doing things slightly differently at every level was what we felt we should do. So we brought in theatre designers and started with that, so that we were trying to create a theatrical set, I suppose, to tell our story in. And then there were a number of times, and it's interesting because as we're talking with Paul today, because I remember talking about things where we were wanting to represent things, but then realizing the sort of futility of trying to make a recording studio that isn't a recording studio look like a recording studio. What do you then do? So then you kind of abstract that and think, well, what are we trying to say here? What's the essence of that? And for us, it's a creative kind of crucible where you can think about what has been created in there. And so we kind of stripped it right back to a tiny room. It is soundproofed, but it's not trying to recreate that. In the same way, the live performance area at the end, you know, that could have been really horrible if we'd been trying to recreate live performance, which isn't. But instead, it was this idea of how do you, you know, what does music do? It brings people together. It kind of almost makes everyone want to put their arms around each other and join together and so on. And it was that kind of experience we wanted to create. And you know, I was you don't even know it's going to work. And I was so thrilled those first few days to go in there and actually see that working and that that was happening.
It's one of the great tricks of curating, isn't it, that you have to imagine what it's like when it's absolutely mobbed with people and the whole time you're working, there's not a soul in the galleries until you open the doors. It's a totally fascinating.
Yeah, and terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose it's a lot like dress rehearsals without an audience, but you have people on stage with you in a sense.
Yes.
So, Paul, what do you think about this immersive sensory experience that
Well, I think it's interesting that in the end it worked perfectly in these rooms because you're dealing with a series of locations, whether that's a recording studio or, you know, 1960s Soho or Berlin or the stage. And in a way, that's what the exhibition represents in sort of abstract form, these different senses of mental and physical locations. And one of the things that really kept it moving for me was, you know, talk about the collaborative effect as well, what made it come alive and be itself was the sound, the way that, you know, the sound becomes constantly, wherever you want to go, you can select your own position, your own place, you can come, it goes in, it goes out, it becomes like a dream. Unbelievable sort of a moment of really confirming how these things can be done in an unexpected way that are unique to themselves, that could only, you know, you don't want to, like Vicky was saying, how do you do performance? Because performance only belongs where it belongs. So it's fabulous what when you're actually in the exhibition to realize this could only be in an exhibition, these things could only happen in this space. So something new has been created to represent the inexplicable sometimes elements of pop music and what pop music is.
Yeah, Vicky, that's accomplished with this rather extraordinary technology that we worked on with Sennheiser.
That's right.
This proximity-based headphones. So you walk up to a costume, let's say, and you hear a piece of music.
That's right. Yeah, it's underlaid. It's in the floor. And so from the moment you put on your headphones, you're on a journey where they know it knows where you are. And so it delivers sound to you. So it's not an audio tour. I hate audio tours. It's a soundtrack to the thing. And it does give this idea that you're on your personal journey. And I was a bit worried at the outset that because knowing what a sociable experience going to an exhibition at the V&A is, I thought people, I didn't want them to feel cut off when they wanted to talk to people. But in fact, you can talk through them. But I'm amazed to see hardly anybody does. They do actually really like going on their personal journey. And occasionally somebody shouts at somebody else because they've got their music turned up loud. But
they really get lost in it.
I think it creates the experience without it being sentimental. It can still be about memories and about remembering things and being reminded of where you were and what was happening at the time. But somehow without it just being a nostalgic act, it's a creative act, isn't it? It's still of the future. It's something that, you know, you can imagine happening more and more in your life, that life itself becomes like that. And that's why I felt it was important to have those innovative elements within in it itself, the exhibition.
Right on that point. Could I just ask you both one last question, Vicky, maybe starting with you, talking about the future. What do you think the future of curating pop music might be, beginning with the V&A? What might we be able to achieve both technologically and curatorially in the next 10, 20, 50 years?
I hope that the Bowie exhibition has laid the ground quite well for the future now. It's been responded to very positively. It's had a great critical reception and lots of visitors. And I think it's shown that we can do these things really well. So I hope, along with people coming and having a great time, that the message will get out as well, that the V&A collects pop, takes it seriously, and we're a great place if you want to give your collection. We're a great place to do that. And through that, I hope that we'll do many more. I think it's also something that kind of illuminates other areas. It's very good that it can sit amongst the sort of cross-cultural departments that we have in the V&A and the way in which we're increasingly working, where we don't get stuck in, you know, it's not just about silver. It's all about ideas and it's about things all around us. And I think there's a long way for it to go.
Paul, what do you see ahead of us?
Well, I have been concerned in a way that various rock acts and pop acts might want to just hijack the idea, if you like, and come in and have one too, because David Bowie's had one, and I'm sure because being inundated with people coming along.
Offers.
And saying,
can we play?
Yeah, whatever the phrase is. And that concerns me to an extent because I think it needs to hold, as I've sort of implied at the beginning of the conversation, that the critical sort of perspectives have shifted a lot. And I see museums and galleries more and more as important areas where a critical shape can be maintained. So I think it's important who, what, how it's done, that it doesn't get, you know, like I say, just turned into a series of gimmicky recreations of the idea that, you know, certain ways of approaching genres and decades and styles, as well as individual acts. And obviously, as someone who took rock music very important as a critic, I think this is a key moment of that development. So I would obviously like to see not... I was going to say some names. I won't say any names, but the Barbar exhibition, you know, and it's lots of costumes and lots, you know, somehow the spirit of David Bowie. And there's very few, obviously, to choose from in terms of they're going to be like David Bowie. So, but in a sense, keeping that caliber, keeping it at that level, so that it doesn't become what actually the first set of critics sort of suggested it would be. So, I've got concerns, but also excitement, because I think it was a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant beginning, a kind of template for how good it could be done.
Hmm. Well, that was a fantastic discussion, and I think that's a great place to leave it as well. A good reminder of not only what pop music can bring to the museum, but also in the long term, what the museum will be able to bring the pop music industry. And I think our critical distance and our rigorous curatorial methodologies have a lot to do with that. So thank you very, very much both to Vicky Brooks and also to Paul Morley. And I hope you've enjoyed listening to this discussion, and also that you'll join us again for the next episode of the V&A podcast, bringing you behind the scenes of the Victoria and Albert Museum, the world's greatest museum of art and design.